This is Fresh Air. Crime novels have been dominated by white detectives. Walter Mosley is the creator of today's most popular African-American detective, E.Z. Rollins. I spoke with Mosley in 1990, after the publication of his first E.Z. Rollins novel, Devil in a Blue Dress. The story is set in Los Angeles in 1948. E.Z. Rollins, a World War II veteran, just got laid off from his job at a defense plant for standing up to his boss. E.Z. is broke, so he accepts an offer from a white gangster to track down a white woman who has a predilection for black men. The search takes E.Z. into all the black bars he knows, but it also leads him into parts of the white world he is unfamiliar with, people and places that are very threatening. This is the opening of Devil in a Blue Dress.
I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he wore an off-white linen suit and shirt with a Panama straw hat and bone shoes over flashing white silk socks. His skin was smooth and pale with just a few freckles. One lick of strawberry blonde hair escaped the band of his hat. He stopped in the doorway, filling it with his large frame, and surveyed the room with pale eyes, not a color I'd ever seen in a man's eyes. When he looked at me, I felt a thrill of fear, but that went away quickly because I was used to white people by 1948. I had spent 5 years with white men and women, from Africa to Italy, through Paris and into the fatherland itself. I ate with them and slept with them, and I killed enough blue-eyed young men to know that they were just as afraid to die as I was.
Now, your novel set in 1948, which is around 4 years before you were born.
Yeah.
This is based on stories your father told you? I don't mean the story of the novel, but the setting, the period.
Yeah, the idea is when I was a little kid, maybe five, six, seven, I would be with my father and his friends, and they would tell stories which really kind of came into my heart. I mean, you know, when you're a little kid and you listen to these wild stories that people are telling, they become part of you. So it's like I was alive then, in a way.
What were most of the stories about?
Most of the stories are about survival and having a good time. I think most of the stories are about how hard life was and how enjoyable life was. You know, a story once my father told me he was in a bar with his wife and his cousin. And some guy was bothering his wife. And my father, as a young man, pulls a knife on this guy. And my cousin grabbed the knife out of his hand because she said that if she killed the guy, she could get out of trouble by morning. And she tried to stab the guy, and she stabbed my father instead in the leg.
Jeez.
That was funny. But, like, she was there, my father was there, and they were all laughing about it, and it was, like, a great time. So I thought it was wonderful.
How did she plan, by the way, to get out of trouble if she killed the guy?
There was an idea, at least, that she had that if a man attacked a black woman or had a fight with a black woman, a black man, that the judge wouldn't worry about it, just let him go. In Houston now. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's what they thought.
Now, your character of E.Z. Rollins fought in World War II, and that's where he was first really around a lot of other white men. Was there an equivalent of the war in terms of an experience or something that exposed you to the white world, or did you just grow up in a racially mixed world, unlike your father?
Yeah, my mother's white, and Yeah, I've always been in a racially mixed world. But a lot of the people that I was with, it was new to them, or always new to them. Like white people who had only been around white people most of their lives and most of their important experiences, so I had trouble with black people, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Although your mother was white and your father was black, when you were outside of the family, did people just see you as black as opposed to, you know, being of a mixed background?
Well, yeah, I mean, in America, you're black if you're at all black, right? I mean, there's not really too much difference between being half black or quarter black and all black. I mean, you are, if you are.
There's a scene where E.Z. gets arrested by cops, and he says, well, he's played the game of cops and nigger before. What's the game?
Well, the game is not giving up information, basically. That they're going to have an attitude that you did something wrong. And that's not going to change. And so you're going to have to continually say, I didn't do it. I'm not wrong. And they're going to continually say that you are. And you just have to weather that. Even I've, like, experienced that. I got stopped by a policeman in Los Angeles, in the hills, and the guy actually pulled a gun on me and asked me, did I break into this building that was standing there? And I had to keep saying no. And he kept holding his gun on me, saying, I know you did it. Now all you have to do is tell me. And I was so nervous. But it finally, it just kind of went away after a while.
It's hard to convince someone that you're innocent when they're certain that you're guilty.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's kind of hard to convince yourself, actually. You know, when there's enough pressure to say you're guilty, you feel, well, I'll be safe if I say I'm guilty. He won't shoot me if I do that, or he won't hit me, or he won't put me in jail. Then maybe I'll just say that. But, of course, that doesn't work either.
You know, without giving away too much about your novel, I will say that one character in it is of mixed background,
mm-hmm.
Like you are, but they are really screwed up.
Yeah.
I mean, they cannot handle being part white and part black.
Yeah.
Did you have friends like that who really couldn't handle it?
Well, it's an interesting thing when the idea of being a mulatto in America, because what I said before, externally people see you as being black, but internally, of course, you identify with people who you're close to and you loved. I've been very close to my mother's side of the family as well as my father's. So there's a kind of an alienation you feel from almost everyone, because you'll find, or at least I found when I was growing up, that a lot of black people felt that white people were different, not the same. And that's not something I ever felt. I said, well, you know, white people are like me, because these are people I've known my whole life. So, and as far as that's concerned, yes, I identify with the character that you're talking about in the book.
Is your father still alive?
Yeah. My parents are both alive.
I wonder, since the book seems in a way like, well, an almost homage to your father, I mean, because there seems to be a lot of the stories he told in there. What he thinks of the book?
Well, he likes the book, actually. Though it's very funny. I was talking to him a few months ago when he first read it, and he asked me seriously. I think he says, "Well, Walter, where am I in this book?" And I thought it was so funny, because I told him, I said, "Well, you know, a lot has to do with, you know, your history, your background, and stuff." And but he couldn't notice it, and I thought that was very funny.
Well, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, thank you too.
Walter Mosley recorded in 1990. His latest novel is White Butterfly. Back with Sue Grafton after this break. This is Fresh Air. Women have recently made a lot of inroads into the detective genre. One of the most successful writers is Sue Grafton, creator of Private Eye Kinsey Milhone. Milhone is in her 30s and, quote, twice married, no kids, and currently unattached and likely to remain so given my disposition, which is cautious at best. Grafton's first Milhone novel, A is for Alibi, was published in 1982. She's worked her way up through the alphabet to J, which is J is for Judgment. I spoke with Sue Grafton in 1989 and asked her about the first Kinsey Milhone novel, which ended with Milhone facing a moral crisis. She killed someone in self-defense. She says, quote, "The shooting disturbs me still. It has moved me into the same camp with soldiers and maniacs. I never set out to kill anyone. I'll recover, of course. I'll be ready for business again in a week or two, but I'll never be the same."
What I am interested in doing, aside from the fact of the mystery itself, is talking about its effect on Kinsey Milhone. One of the things that always seemed true of me of mysteries in general is the prime character, the protagonist, seems not to be affected by the murder and mayhem. And I wanted to use Kinsey Milhone not only as a way of observing society, but showing her reaction and the changes it brings about in her own personality. So I think you'll see her grow and change because of the violence.
When you started writing detective fiction, were you self-conscious about being a woman and self-conscious about figuring out how to make this a more feminist crime series than a macho one?
No, I was self-conscious, but primarily because I was ill at ease with some of the technicalities of writing detective fiction. When I started AS for Alibi, I didn't even know what a private investigator did. So in the course of writing that book, I did a lot of reading on forensics and California criminal law, ballistics, auto and theft and burglary and that sort of thing. And I think my self-consciousness was the sense of not being qualified to do the writing. And one of the reasons I made Kinsey Millhone female is because I felt like that was an area in which I had a little expertise.
What other kinds of research did you have to do before you felt confident in writing a convincing crime story?
I learned to shoot a handgun. I took women's self-defense. All of the books take me down dark alleys. For instance, when I did See Us for Corpse, I went to visit two morgues so that I would know what that looked like. I did a ride-along with the police in Santa Barbara one night, and that was a bit of an eye-opener because I tend to go to bed very early, and to see what goes on in that town after 10 o'clock was sort of astonishing.
Now, it's interesting. Your detective, Kinsey Millhone, has no family. Her parents were killed in a car accident when she was 5 years old. And I'd like to read something that she says in F is for Fugitive, your new book.
All right.
Now, in this scene, she's having dinner with a family. They're all pretty crazy in this family. And she says, "As a child, I didn't experience much in the way of family, and I usually find myself somewhat taken aback to see one at close range. The Donna Reed Show, this was not. People talk about dysfunctional families. I've never seen any other kind." You know, one of the things I always find interesting in most detective novels is that the character has kind of given up on the idea of family.
Mm.
They don't have any expectations for it.
All right. Well, I know Kinsey will never marry again. She will never have children. But part of that is because I think the tradition of the hard-boiled private eye is that of a loner, the sort of knight-errant. And in part, I made those choices because in the writing of detective fiction, I didn't want to stop and deal with Aunt Maudie and Uncle Herman and everybody gathered around. So she has a sort of surrogate family in Henry Pitts and Rosie, the woman who owns the tavern in her neighborhood. But I didn't want to deal with family gatherings at Christmas time and that sort of thing. So it is a choice I made, and I feel it's the correct one in terms of the kind of book I'm writing.
When you started this series, how did you come up with the A is for Alibi? And did you think at the time that you would be committing yourself to a B, C, D, E, F, and so on?
It had been in the back of my mind to try a series based on something. So A is for Alibi came out of a personal situation of my own in which I was going through a very bitter divorce. And at the time, I was not very effectual as a fighter. I have since learned quite a lot about how to fight legal battles, but I used to lie awake at night and think of ways to kill the man. However, because I am such a law-abiding little bun, I knew I'd get caught at it. For one thing, I think the cops are very smart. I think people are foolish who imagine they can outwit the police. And I am the sort of person who does not even turn a library book in late. Also, if I get a parking ticket, I know they're discussing me down at the police station, and that makes me uncomfortable. So I decided that the next best thing would be to take the murder, put it in a book, and get paid for it. And in essence, I have launched an entire new career for myself out of mere homicidal rage.
You know, we were talking earlier about being a woman writing crime fiction in which there's a woman detective. There's a group called Sisters in Crime, which is an organization of women who write crime novels, and from what I understand, you've decided not to join.
That's right, and I'll tell you some of my reasons. I'm so happy you asked me that. For starters, I don't think writing is gender-related, and I prefer to keep the politics out of writing. I see us as one group. I see our problems as applying to all of us, whether we're male or female. I also don't think I need to join a group to show that I am pro-women. And I am, I suspect, too much of a rebel, and Kinsey is too much of a renegade to connect myself to any group. I'm tired of getting people's newsletters. You know, every time you join a group, they send you this crappy newsletter, and I just don't want to do that anymore. I want to keep the writing pure for that, you know?
Well, it's funny you should say that. A friend of mine who reads a lot of crime fiction always thinks it's very funny that any detective writer who spends their days and nights writing about loners would care to join an organization.
That's right. That's right.
But do you find, though, that your concerns as a woman writer, are ever at odds with some of the men in the crime writing profession?
I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I have found the men in Mystery Writers of America some of the warmest, most supportive people. I don't like to get into the us against them mentality, and I don't, in truth, think that's what Sisters in Crime is saying. I don't think they're maintaining that it is the men in MWA who are the enemy. I think their concerns are related to reviewers and critics and publishers and that sort of thing, but to my way of thinking, the book business is about selling books, and it seems to me if you are a writer who earns money for a publisher, you will be treated well.
Was there a time when you would have joined Sisters in Crime if for no other reason than to not alienate other women in it?
Yeah, see, but that did go through my mind, too, because when I first understood I wasn't going to do it, it scared me silly. But I thought, wait a minute, these people don't have any power over me, and I'm not going to do things in my life anymore just because of the way it looks. If I don't believe it, I'm not going to do it. But I am not the only one, you know. I am not the Lone Ranger out there. There are many other women who were feeling pressured by the organization and who determined that they also did not want to join. We just haven't formed a group because we don't like groups.
Have you found that Kinsey Millhone's courage is contagious?
Yes. Often I find that I look at the world through her eyes, and I think to myself, Kinsey Millhone would not be intimidated, and therefore, whether it scares me or not, I had better straighten up my act.
Sue Grafton, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sue Grafton recorded in 1989. Her latest novel is Jay is for Judgment. This is Fresh Air.